Thank you for being here.
And everybody's
here.
He was a bit worried as he got lost. The taxi driver brought him to the wrong street corner.
Well, he got to a place where he couldn't turn either right or left.
That's Neil, that's Ronan, that's Patricia, and this is Adelaide. You won't remember all those names. We have a few people missing today, but we can't do anything about them. And we've spent the last couple of weeks talking about remembering Babylon, and these students are deep into writing an essay about remembering Babylon. Okay. So they're keen for insights and information, but they're also keen to hear from yourself as an author, as an established writer. So maybe David, you might. Well, do you want to say something first, Coralie? Do you want
just a wee fraction? I can't stay the full length of this. I will try, but I may not, sir. For me, a dabbler in literature, unfortunately, but love it. A choreographer with movement as the main underlying meaning and force with the story always. This wonderful story of yours, Remembering Babylon. A marvellous, deep, wonderful work. And that you, how could this happen to a human being? What is behind all this? Is this your heritage? Way back in Jerusalem, way back I had to go with you in that story. I haven't got any little aspects to point out because it's all like climbing Everest and wondering who is the human being behind all this. Your heritage, sir, must have been prompting you all the way.
Well, I wouldn't say that, but
it's
for somebody else to say that. The whole experience actually began with a dance performance. Because back in about 1991, maybe the middle 80s, when the Aboriginal Islander Dance Company existed.
Yes.
Before they were Bangarra. I went to a performance of theirs one night, and I came very late. It was at Belvoir Theatre.
Oh.
And the only place they had for me was in the very front row. So I went rushing down to the front row, and that was right down low, and the stage was here. Literally, I was sitting in the front row, and the stage was there. And it was dark. And when the lights came on, there was an Aboriginal man, an old Aboriginal man, who had been brought down from the Northern Territory, because in those days they used to bring Indigenous people down to dance with them. And he was dancing, but pretending to be a goanna, a huge goanna. And I was so scared that I thought, I can't do this. I've got to get up and rush out of the theatre. And that was the original impetus, because one of the things I thought of was way back in the middle of the 19th century, when no one had ever come across an Indigenous person before, to find yourself very, very close up to somebody like that is to say, so what is it to be human? You know, what does that say about me?
Yes, yes.
And especially as this man was not presenting himself as human at all, but as a goanna. And I was pretty convinced of that. And so that was really the beginning of this thing. And it was really a question about the distance between being a white European person coming to this country and being confronted for the first time by somebody that you had to recognize as human, but who was so distant from you that you couldn't imagine how wide that space was, or and how wide a space of time that might be. And that's really what I added to that was a story which kids in Queensland had heard over and over again. And that was the story of somebody called Jenny Morell, who had actually been shipwrecked as a 13-year-old boy, and who said those words, those other words, which are the real key to the book, which is, do not shoot.
I am the British object. Yes.
And it was the other question was, what is the difference between a subject and an object?
And an object.
So out of those three things, that's what the book was made. That is how the book was made.
That's where it was triggered. That's where the
yes. And I departed pretty almost completely from the story of Jenny Morell. Apart from the fact that that's what happened to him, all the rest is made up. Because he, in fact, was a middle-class grammar-educated schoolboy when he was shipwrecked. So he wasn't the person I created, who was a kind of an illiterate, abandoned
He was abandoned. He was abandoned.
Okay, lovely. Beautiful. Thank you, Coralie, for that question, that opening up question. So we're going to go around the room, and each person is going to ask what they've thought about. So Rima, it's over to you. Rima, would you like to say a little bit about yourself briefly? About where you're from and why you're studying literature.
Okay, I was born in Iran, and I am an Armenian by ethnicity, and I am learning literature because I used to write in Farsi.
Oh, yeah.
And I can't do that anymore because it's going to be rusty, my Farsi. And so I am in the middle of nowhere.
That's right.
English is so vast that I don't know if I can ever. And your work is really inspiring. It's absolutely beautiful. Every page is like so rich with imageries, with, well, we all know about that. But my question is about the Jenny, this famous quote that Jenny is standing on the rail.
Yeah.
And this word yet is a bit, concerns me. Why is, it says overbalanced but not yet falling. What do you mean by that yet?
He was balancing on the fence, and was going to fall off the fence eventually. But this is the moment before he actually falls off the fence. So he's still between two worlds. But when he falls off the fence, he will either fall back on his side, or he'll fall over into their side.
Okay.
And in fact, he comes down on their side.
It has a deeper meaning, doesn't it have deeper meaning? But does it mean that we are expected to fall generally? Because in deeper sense of the
The word fallen doesn't have that kind of significance for me.
Okay.
Don't believe in fallen. Religious sense, no.
Yes.
None of us have fallen.
Continues.
Are you going to come through this way, Coralie?
I am coming through.
Okay, good, yep.
Can I take this one?
Roll it. It's too heavy to carry. Yeah. I will fix it. That bowl will help me fix it outside my eye.
Thank you for your
beautiful question. When he's out on the sand, coming up to see all the strange people and everything, and the way it's a piece of choreography where he's flapping and he's like a bird. It's a beautiful piece of writing, and you could do it in a ballet. He's like a bird. Things are flapping here, things are flapping there, the legs are flying here, the body is over there. It's beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you,
everyone.
I really meant that he's balanced at that moment between the two worlds, between
yes,
the worlds
yes.
he's coming from and the world he's about to go into. And in some ways, that notion of the fence is important in the book.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
The border, yeah.
Yes,
yes.
In a way, though, he falls both ways by the end of the novel, doesn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, Song, would you like to just say a little bit about your background and your interest?
Hello, I'm from South Korea, living in Australia as a second home. And I'm an English learner.
Oh, yeah.
When I read the book, it reminds me of certain situation of these people who come from North Korea to South Korea looking for freedom,
yeah.
struggle to... become one of us. Eventually, they couldn't really make it, and then either go back to that dictatorship country, or either looking for somewhere else, like USA. So it is a very interesting book. And I went through several stages when I read this book because it's really difficult to understand. And I just slightly seeing a little of understanding now. And my question is about Janet. It's very interesting that she was standing beside Jimmy, take this journey with a very deep insight of him, that Jimmy himself my struggle to figure out, find out, define himself, which is Janet, bring out very clear idea, and somewhat I sense that her interpretation is leading readers to understand of this remembering Babylon, and then I was struggled to string to this title with this the book context. Then when I read about Janet, I feel a bit, she's kind of like a singing when she bring her opinion alongside this story. It's rather sound like a, some sort of a singing about like a remembering, continuous action. So, is that Janet's role, purposely take that part, or either if I misunderstood it?
Is she one?
Purposely
she,
taken this path as singing a memory of Jimmy, singing him into existence.
That's a difficult question.
Yeah, it rather seems like she's the one continuously seeing, remembering Babylon, so this
title.
Yeah, yeah. It's like I cannot define myself about remembering Babylon when I read the book. It's too complicated. But then in bigger picture, Janet's interpretation, which is happened over and over, even in each moment, that all of together sounds like that's what remembering Babylon, that was she, you know.
Look, saying. Maybe we should talk a bit about the title, because the title came to the book long after the book was finished, and I didn't have a title for the book. It was just called Jemmy or something like that, and I didn't have a title. And I thought that the book belonged very, very much in the world of Blake. And so
William
I thought,
Blake.
William Blake.
The poet.
The poet. And I thought if I go and look at some Blake, I'll eventually stumble on a possible title. And I found the line in Blake about whether we are in Babylon or in Jerusalem, we know not. Now, what Jerusalem represents is the finished city, the place where everything is now orderly and where justice exists and fairness exists and where people are fully human at last.
Love. Hmm? And love.
And love exists. And Babylon is where we all are, which is a world still of disorder and unfinished business and injustice and inequality and unfairness.
Tragedy.
And misunderstanding. And so what this book is about asking us to remember that that's where we are. So it's about all of those unfinished things. So that's really what the book, that's what the title is meant to evoke. But I don't think you should base too many arguments in the book on the title, and not be misled by the idea of Babylon as a place of exile, for example, and Jerusalem as goodness knows what. But, you know, Jerusalem, the city of God, we're not there.
But is it a fair question to say that Janet, in a sense, is the reader's guide to who and what Jemmy is?
Yes, Janet is the person in the book who has the clearest vision of Jemmy's other life. And she recognises him in his absolutely most human terms, without any fear of what he might represent. Because what most people who are faced with him feel is what I felt at that moment in that theatre, which is
horror.
You know, horror. And the question has been now put to me about my humanity. And this one particularly, because in, you know, all of those people have come to Australia from England or Scotland or wherever. And they are all poor people, mostly all uneducated people. And the one thing they have, which is a source of superiority, is that they are Europeans. They are English or Scots or whatever.
They're people.
Yes. And they, what they are, when they look at what has happened to Jemmy, they say, once he was like us, he was English and a nice little white boy. And now look at him. You can't tell whether he's white or black. You can't tell whether he belongs to us or belongs to the country in some kind of way. And what they say to themselves is, if I stay here long enough, is that what will happen to me? And is that what will happen to my children? And that's the source of their fear. What he has presented them with is a question about what they will become if they give themselves entirely over to this foreign country, this foreign place, this foreign landscape, and all this. That's the source of their fear. And Janet never feels that.
Yeah. Beautiful. Okay. Did you want to come in on that, Patricia?
Well, it's just that, I mean, within the settlement, that fear wouldn't be would be ungrounded because
they don't mix with them.
You know, yeah. I mean, fair enough if they sent their children off to be, or they themselves associated with the Aboriginals and lived their life. Then that would be a grounded fear that maybe we would become like them. But while they were closeted in that settlement, how could they feel like? How could they have that sort of fear?
They fear that because of the massacre that happened at the river. It says in the book how they obtained their fear.
That's right.
Yeah.
There was a massacre that was referred to. So there was a fear. There was a fear of the other.
Yeah, but not of becoming them.
Well, how did it happen to Jemmy?
Yes, but I mean, they're living in a settlement. And Jemmy lived totally in the scrub country with the Aboriginals.
Yeah, but
he saw no other life but that.
But over time, if you let the country shape you, is that not going to happen? Aren't we even afraid of that in a way now? You know, we think, what if we decide that our European way of reading the country is not superior to that of indigenous people's reading of the country. What if we decide...
Well, I come from an indigenous heritage. I'm part of the stolen generation. I'm a product from the stolen generation. I identify as Aboriginal, but I'm white.
And he's called...
I walk past an Aboriginal man and he calls me brother, he calls me cousin.
Yeah.
I walk past a white man and he says hello.
Yeah.
So I related to Jimmy very, very much.
Yeah.
Yeah. And some of what you've said, I've already, you know, the ideology of the book has great significance to my heritage.
Yeah.
And...
This is a man who 2 weeks ago said, I don't understand this book.
Well, I did. It drove me mad. I was actually going to throw it at you, but Michael suggested I didn't do that.
Yeah.
I wouldn't really do that. But I don't want to take away from it what other people are asking their questions. So.
No, but you're with you. Stay with your question now since you're here.
Some of the things that you've just mentioned, I've written... in my essay. Word for word, I've just written in my essay. So that's how much I've understood the balance between, you know, black and white, you know, the native tongue and the normal tongue. You know, being shaped by your country and not being shaped by your country.
Mm.
Yeah. The settlers were shaped by their country already. Yeah? They've come here and then they've imposed.
Yep.
All right? Because of the Terra Nullius thing, yeah, that's allowed them to impose. But instead of learning and learning from the country and working with the country, still to this day, we work against this country. But my question is, I understand the ideology of it, but my question is, why use the name Jemmy Fairley, or is it Fairley Jemmy? As the ideology of this book is about early colonisation of the country, does that name have any significance? And why doesn't Jemmy have a voice of his own? And what do you think Jemmy's effect was on the community?
Yeah, look, I think the book poses a whole lot of questions, rather than offers any kind of answers. And what it really is about in terms of those questions is, yes, you have a settled place, but those people also all see things differently. So that Andy, for example, is a very different person from Jock, and you know, his wife is a different person from Jock. And the question is, let's take this small settlement, which has already got a division between Irish and Scots, or between Catholics and Protestants. And now you introduce an element which is from outside. Do they unite against him? Or does he increase the divisions between them? That's what the book sets out to look at. And the question really is why people react in one way or the other. What is it they're afraid of? And I think they're afraid of the fact that, you know, at that point in Queensland, because the settlements are hopping, they've got an Indigenous world in front of them and an Indigenous world behind them as well. And it's a very long way to the next white settlement. So they are absolutely isolated. So there's that question. But the bigger question is the question which Neil has raised, and which I was raising, which is, what happens if this country, where all the seasons are different, where all the stars are different, where wet and dry have a different kind of meaning. What happens if you let all of that change, all your culture and habits of thought and your language, for example? Because what they see in Jemmy is somebody who has entirely accepted that world and become part of it. Now, not entirely, because he is taken in by the indigenous people, and he is sort of tolerated by them, but there is maybe no more place for him there than there is in the white world. So, you know, he's somebody now who's between cultures, but that's a scary concept. To feel that you can fall out of your culture is a scary concept.
That's why one must be at one with their country.
Yeah, and the other question which you've asked is he lost. I looked at a lot of examples of people who went off and lived with indigenous people.
He lost his tongue.
And there are people who lost their language absolutely completely.
Yes.
And there are people who kept a couple of words as he has. One of the reasons why I didn't want to give him a voice was because I didn't want to claim to be able to enter completely into his situation. I wanted him to exist in the book as an outsider to the people in the book, but he is also an outsider to the author and to the reader.
And yet he has an influence on a number of the characters.
I thought he had a voice.
He spoke all the four words.
Okay, not the voice, but I mean, you got to understand a lot about what he thought.
Oh yes, yeah. You can suggest in some way, usually through the way other people see him, what he might be thinking. But I don't think anybody in that book knows ever what he is really thinking or what he is really feeling, except that Janet has a very strong feeling for him. But I think even she would say that she doesn't know what he's thinking.
And that's what
but even when he went to get the paper, when he got his papers, even then he said, I don't have to go down that road. I'm pleased, I can go anywhere. I mean, that's a voice, sure.
That's a person. And that's a will.
But his voice.
Yes.
And there's lots of instances of that.
But that's a real problem for the writer, is when, knowing when you can't fully enter into the speech of the person, because you don't know how speech and thought are related. Mm. What is he thinking in? As it is written on the page, he's thinking in English because that's what I'm writing in.
Yes.
But how do we know that that's what he's thinking in?
Yeah. Because he's brought up with Aborigines. You know, I mean, he learnt their tongue. He learnt how to get food and water. He survived.
Yeah.
You know, he was Australian, a little white boy found on the beach. You know, and he forced himself upon the indigenous people until they accepted
him. Yeah. The other thing that interested me is that when he falls among those indigenous people, he is no less an outsider than he has been in the white society he's come from. Because in the white society he's come from, he is complete outcast.
Yes.
Misused and with no real place. So he's really... And even when he's on shipboard, he still is very precarious. So he's lived a whole life where where there is no provision really made for a person like him.
Except he does hanker after Willett.
Yes. Might be a bit perverse.
It is, but I mean, nevertheless, you know, he always wants to go back. I mean, he saw him as a provider.
Yes, yes.
As his place.
Because he was the only person he knew.
Yes.
He was his God.
Look, none of that is outrageous. I did quite a lot of reading of there's a man called Henry Mayhew who wrote a very large book about social conditions in England in the 1840s. And a lot about children, and especially outcast children and children who lived in the streets or worked in factories and things. So almost nothing that the book says about him is exaggerated.
No.
And you discover that too if you read some Dickens.
Josh.
So, hi.
Josh, do you want to say a little bit about yourself?
Okay, so my name is Josh, and I'm really interested in poetry and drama, because I used to do a lot of drama when I was young. And I'm also very interested in movies as well. And that's why I like reading a book, because it reminded me so much of watching a whole movie in front of me, you know? And it looks very familiar to me as well. Like, I've seen it before on film, you know, something similar. And especially when it came to a character named Mr. Fraser, who was the botanist, I was really interested in his diary that he wrote about what he'd written and about how his experience with Jemmy, how he experienced with Jemmy and what he felt with Jemmy. And as I was reading his diary, of Mr. Fraser's diary in the book, I could see the visual aspect of how I could see it in the scene. It was like a movie scene. And like I said, it was very familiar to me. And I was just wondering, a couple of questions came to my head. One, what was the inspiration to create Mr. Fraser? And two, has there been similar movies based on your story on Remembering Babylon?
Yes. Mr. Fraser really represents, I think, someone who very idealistically believes that you can go out there into the country and embrace the country and discover all its differences and all its truths and take them in, and that will not be a danger to you. So he's someone who in some ways is looking far forward, perhaps, but he is also, his idealism is also there, because one of the things he never realises is that there are people all around watching. You know, when he's out with Jemmy, there's all those shadows behind the trees. He never sees any of that. What he's concentrating on is the plants and all this, and he's doing a very, very good job of that. But in some ways, he's ignoring these presences. Jemmy knows they're there, and he knows that they're being watched the whole time, and they're not in danger. But Mr. Fraser doesn't realise that. So he has a kind of area of blindness as well as an area of wisdom. When you talk about the thing, this book, almost as soon as it was written, was taken up to film rights. And it had three lots of people who, three American companies who took the option and got as far as writing the script, and I even went out with them and we found all the places where it was going to be filmed and all the rest of it. Never happened.
Never happened?
No.
Because you never saw the script?
I saw the script. It's a very, very good script by somebody called Daniel O'Keefe, who's a very good Melbourne playwright. And he came up to the Gold Coast and we all went out in a helicopter and we looked at various places in the hinterland at the Gold Coast and on Stradbroke Island. There's a real problem, and that is that, you know, I was brought up on film, as almost all of us are, and the largest influence on writing in the last century has been film, because we all see things when we're writing visually. So everything I write is very, very clearly photographic.
Yeah.
And that has led a lot of people to believe that it would be easy to turn this into a film. What you've really got to say is what I try to say to them, but they never listen, is that if you actually look at these books, nothing happens. Everything happens in someone's head.
Yeah.
And that you can't make a film out of that.
You can't make a dream.
So there's nothing similar to that film, to that book that they made or something?
No, look, the first ones who did it decided that they were going to translate it all to the United States, and it was all going to be about an Indian.
Okay.
Somebody who goes and lives with the Indians. That fell to pieces, fortunately.
Yes.
The second one was the good one, the one that Daniel O'Keefe and other Americans did. But I don't really know a film that's quite like that.
Okay.
You know, there are films about people who go and live with someone else. If you've ever seen The Searchers, for example, that
Lost
John
Boy's
Wayne
another
film.
One as well.
Which
Lost,
one?
Lost Boy. It's a new movie. I'm not too sure who made it, but
recent.
Yeah, it is recent. What's his name? Stan Grant and someone else was on a review.
It's about
Indigenous boys, so it's swapped around.
Oh, yes. Yeah, no, I know the one you mean.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's been swapped around. So it's about an Indigenous boy.
And his grandfather or something like that.
Yeah. And then they find themselves in the middle of it in the city. You know what I mean? Because of, you know, his grandfather's sick. Well, his grandfather dies.
Yeah.
And now he's lost in the city. He doesn't know. He's like from the country.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But he sees all these horrific things, and all he can visualise is home. You know what I mean? And he's got to take his grandfather back to country.
Yeah.
But he can't get out of this world because it's so ideological. You know, it's like everything's based on material things. You know, so
yeah.
But there is that one thing that is similar.
Can we come back to you? Just hold the question. I'll just let everybody else to get a chance in before we have to finish. So, Ronan, would you like to say a little bit about yourself first and then ask your question about why you're studying literature and your interest and so on a little bit?
Yeah. My name's Ronan. I've had a bit of a colourful past. A rough life. Been out of prison my whole life and 30 years old now and just trying to find a different avenue and source of different ideas to make a living, I suppose, and just trying to get in touch with my creative side, doing art and literature, interested in poetry and writing songs and stuff. I just like to say that it was the most descriptive novel that I have read thus far. Very beautiful and also very, very stressful at times too, you know. If I'd have read it in a different setting, I'm sure I would have enjoyed it a lot more, but because there's a bit of a time constraint on it, it's a difficult read to read under time constraint, you know, because it just seemed like a chore at times, whereas when I was enjoying it, it was actually quite a very, very intense and colourful book. My question was just what inspired you to be such a descriptive author, or was it just your personality or
what
style?
Do you mean by descriptive?
Well, I just thought it was like if I was to I thought the book was read for theatre, was written for theatre or something like that. Just because the amount of detail that it goes into, and you know, there's that many commas throughout the book, and it's just very, very descriptive. And you know, I've never read anything like it. You know, and I just was wondering where that what kind of problem did it
do? Yeah, look, I think why you put a lot of detail in the book about something like weather or light or how things feel or whatever, is that you're really trying to put the reader right at the centre of the experience. And your belief is that if you give the reader the kind of details that make the background of the book surround him and close in, that means that it ceases to become just a reading experience. It becomes something like a real experience. And I can only say that that's what I think reading does for you. It gives you another form of experience, like real experience. So that there are many, many times when you have a memory of something that you think happened, and you think, oh yeah, wasn't that wonderful when? And you suddenly say, actually, that didn't actually happen to me. It was something that I read. And, you know, the reading experience becomes as real in your recall as an experience that happened. In much the same way that, you know, if you grow up in a family and you hear a lot of stories about yourself or about other people, there often comes a time when you think that you remember something that happened. And your parents or something like that were saying, no, look, that, you couldn't remember that. That was a story I told you. But, you know, you watch little kids listening to a story being told, and for them that's real. That's as real as what's happening, you know, down the street or what happened that day in school. And that's the experience that a writer is trying to create for a reader.
And the other thing I'd just add to what you say, Ronan, I mean, you've hit the nail on the head. This book can really only be appreciated if you read it slowly. And I think slow reading is really, you know, what literature is. And we've, you know, in our culture nowadays, so many of us have lost the art of slow reading. We read things quickly, we watch television, we look on our digital devices and so on. But this, what we're having, what you're beginning to have in this course is that facing up to the fact that only through reading slowly will you engage with it. As you said, there were passages there that really kind of filled you with, you know, a sense of the power and the beauty of it. Mm. And then you're also under restraint because you knew you had an essay to write.
Yeah. Mm.
So, you know, it is a question of finding the time. And in that time, you find a new place for yourself, a new relaxation, a new stillness. Instead of all this rushing around and beating your head against the wall, here is a place where you can find a connection, not only with the book, but with yourself and all the things in you that connect with that. So it's good what you're describing. It's very, very real. We all share that. So we got now 10 minutes. Patricia, you would like to say, you've already spoken, but tell us a bit more about yourself. Ask your question.
Okay. My name's Patricia. I was born in Brisbane, and I've spent a lot of time doing secretarial work and so on and so forth, and now I want to just spend the rest of my life reading. So my question is that this book is full of wisdom, spirituality and empathy, especially for the character of Jemmy, and it's a book about the journey of life. Did you have a lot of life experiences to help you understand these things, or did you have to read a lot of literature to understand about wisdom stuff?
Well, that's a really kind of hard question, because you do both. I mean, you have a lot of experience. And, you know, I've usually said to people, you know, that when people want to write, you say to people, well, write out of your own experience. And they say, but, you know, I'm 22.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't had any experience. And you really want to say, look, by the time you're about 10, you've probably had enough experience to write most books. You know, I mean, we all have a lot of experience. The question is not having the experience, but being able either to recall it or see what kind of questions it's throwing up, or finding out which things matter and which don't matter. So, you know, look, anybody, certainly by the time you're 22, 21 or 22, you've got enough experience to write almost anything. I would also say that I think writers are a bit unique in that, again, when people say to you, when did you know you were a writer? Well, I can't answer that question. But if you said to me, when did I begin doing the kind of thing you have to do in order to be a writer, I would say when I was about 3. And what that was becoming a very, very adept little eavesdropper and voyeur, looking through doors that you weren't supposed to be looking through, hovering behind doors, listening to conversations you were not supposed to be, then pretending you were doing something while your mother's talking to some friend and telling her something she doesn't expect you to understand. That's where you learn to be a writer. And if you're going to be a writer, mostly you've been doing that for a very long time, so you've got a lot of experience. But
what, being nosy, basically,
nosy, exactly, yeah,
and, stuff like
and
that.
Saying all the time as a small child,
what's
why
that?
Is my mother saying
yeah.
that? That's not
what's
true.
Yeah,
why is she telling that woman that? That's not what Dad does. You know, and all of those things. And so, you know, it's listening and saying there's a gap between what they're telling me and what's actually true or what they're actually saying. And working out the difference. The other thing is, I think if you want to be a writer, there's nothing better than reading. Reading absolutely everything you can read. But reading really good, hard stuff. And sometimes coming to books and saying, you know, okay, I've just read that. I'm not ready for it. You know, I can remember reading a very famous book, a French book, when I was about 18. And I thought, actually, I'd have to read this book 10 years from now. I've missed it.
Yeah.
Not ready for this.
Yeah. Yeah.
And not be ashamed of that.
Mm.
That you can grow into being able to read a book as well as you know, force yourself to do it.
Mm, mm. Beautiful. Okay, we've got Adelaide. Tell us a bit about yourself and give us your question.
I'm part Maori and I came here in 75 and I thought, you know, it was quite interesting how you wrote, he never heard an intelligent word from one day to the next. Africa, he believed, would have tempered his soul to hardness, discovered the man in him. No such demands were made upon him here. The place worked its defeats in a low way. When I came in 75, it was so white here. And because we had a...
Who was that about, by the way? Jimmy? No.
No, that was George.
Oh, yeah, George, yeah.
Yeah, when it, yeah. And it's just that when I came in 75, it was so white. And I thought, oh my God, you know, where's the colourful, you know, because we had a big Pacific Island influx of migrants in New Zealand, plus the Maori, and it was just such a much richer feeling country to come in here. I felt like I was sort of, the only reason I didn't go home was because everyone would have said, told you that you couldn't, you know, hack it over there, so my pride. But also... Oh, you said something interesting, but I've just forgotten it.
So what is about that passage that you were wanting to ask about?
I don't know if I wanted to, just like,
No intelligent.
The place worked its defeat in a low way. I just sort of thought that, you know, it was just sad that it was so white when, you know, there was a big influx of Vietnamese immigrants and the place started getting more interesting to me. And
yep.
But I did want to ask a rather basic question. Why did Cousin Alexander, George wanted to go to Africa, remember? Why did he send him to Australia? Was it to get that much more distance because he found George somewhat, you know, plain and an embarrassment? Did he send him so far away?
I can't remember. There probably is some reason, but I can't remember it.
Yeah. Oh, because Cousin Alexander, you know, he was the sort of benefactor of the family.
Yeah.
And George, as he grew up, became plainer and plainer. And Cousin Alistair was very much into aesthetics and things, you see.
Yeah.
So the boy sort of fell out of favour. He wasn't paraded.
Maybe he was just trying to get rid of him. I can't remember.
Yeah. Oh,
he only wrote the book.
And a long time ago. Yeah.
I remember a conversation we had with David and some students of mine a year or two ago, and the student asked, what did David mean by this certain passage? And David said, look, the last time I read this book was about 25 years ago when I wrote it. You're the people who will tell me what's in this book. You have the answers. Put a bit of fear into them. So Josh, did you have another question you wanted to ask?
So when I was asking about the film part of it and how it related to Mr. Fraser as well, the vision that I saw in the book of Mr. Fraser, and especially his diary when he was associating with
Jemmy,
was that it reminded me a little bit of the Rabbit-Proof Fence scene when the tracker, the Aboriginal tracker, goes with the white guys, the white people, to try and find the stolen children. They were stolen. They escaped. But however, the tracker then realizes that I'm since I'm part Indigenous, like them, I feel I might as well help the girls instead of these people. And that's what I noticed with it was sort of similar to what I was seeing in the book, because I don't know if this is correct, but Fraser seems to be it seems Fraser and Jemmy seem to get on really, really well. You know, like, as you know, they're starting to, you know, he's liking Fraser and Fraser's liking him, and that's why Fraser ends up giving Jemmy's story to George, or whatever his name is. Was it George?
Yeah.
Is that correct, that am I saying that there is some element to there is a trust thing happening between Fraser and Jemmy, because him realizing, because in the beginning they're like, let's destroy all these Indigenous, and Fraser's coming along with them, and then Fraser's like, in the end, you're thinking, okay, well, I trust Jemmy very much. Is that what I'm seeing in the story?
That's true. Yeah.
I mean, Fraser's the only person who really, well, not the only person, but he articulates his sense of why Jemmy is so important for the future.
Yeah, he sees Jemmy as a forerunner, but I believe that the book in itself still carries and weighs a very big message in today's society.
Tell us what it is, Neil.
I have chosen this topic as I have also been given the privilege of seeing the effect that Jemmy Fairley has on the community. I say the word has, as after you read this book and the way in which David Moyf writes, still to this day, although somewhat fictional, has a profound effect on all Australians. And I can explain this by the true message that's so passionately written. It's a sense of community and the unknown, fear that still resonates in today's society. So, if you read the book, it still resonates in today's society. Jemmy Fairley's character still resonates with everybody in today's society.
Yeah.
In the year 2000, 2 million people walked across that bridge, but at the end of the day, they still fear.
Mm.
They still have an inner fear of a black man. I've also, much the same as him, been in and out of prison all my life. And unfortunately, the prisons have racially segregated everybody. So where do I go? I had a pretty hard time because I wasn't accepted in the white fella's yard because I was an Aboriginal, but I was too white to be in the black fella's yard. Yeah? So Jemmy's character really, really, I assimilate to him in a way like it's real. It resonates today in a really, really big way.
Still unresolved questions, big unresolved questions.
Well, the unresolved questions are pretty simple. Is that the people have been on the country, they understand the country, they've worked with the country for 40,000 years, right? And there's sites that have significance. And those significant sites are from the Dreamtime. Now, a didgeridoo is always played to the ground. It's not played to the air. And the reason a didgeridoo is played to the ground is so it can vibrate and awaken the Dreamtime. And those spirits of the Dreamtime, which in turn gives those Indigenous dancers that power to create a performance which gives you that fear.
Mm.
Wow.
So, an Indigenous person sees the country different. We see things that a white man can't see. We can look at a rock, and we can see the dreaming in that rock. And it doesn't matter how much we try to explain it and try and show them the colours and the way the rifts move in the rock, and you know the why that rock bulges out, and you know how come that rock's on the ground here. They can't understand it. They can't see it. The only way that we see it is because we are one with our country. You know what I mean? And unfortunately, a white man won't be able to see that unless he's willing to take his shoes off and barefoot and go to country and live and learn and see the country from an Indigenous perspective, like Jimmy Fairley did.
Beautiful. I think on that lovely note, and thank you very much, Neil, and all of you, let's all especially thank David for moving.
Thank you very much.
And I think David has, I haven't actually asked him, but I'm going to ask him now whether he's happy to give, to sign copies of the books that you have.
So he's my book down. My book's upstairs.
You go and get it, run quick.
I thought we had to hand them back.
No, they're yours. You don't have to hand them back. Whoever said that?
You did. You said him and him back.
Did I?
Yeah, because you put them in out of the box.
I didn't. Well, if I did, I'd take it back.
Okay.
It's your book.
Yeah. Get it, I'll get it signed for sure. Because the amount it frustrated me, and Michael knows how much it frustrated me, but the message is what's most important. So, is it okay if I get your signature? Thank you very much.
Absolutely.
And it's an honour to meet you, actually, for a person of
Patricia.